You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the musical Hamilton has been the hottest ticket on Broadway. Now it's taking Chicago by storm, but there are some parts about Hamilton's legacy and the early years of our nation that our guest says are missing from the story.
First, a new report shows Wisconsin has seen a nearly 10% drop in the number of written opioid prescriptions compared to this time last year. Opioid refers to any drug with morphine-like effects, including illegal drugs like heroin and prescription painkillers like oxycodone. These drugs have a high potential for addiction and abuse, and drug experts say a heroin addiction can often start with a legally prescribed painkiller.
Dr. Don Dexter joins us now to talk about the news. He's chief medical officer for the Wisconsin Medical Society. Dr. Dexter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob.
So a 10% drop in written opioid prescriptions we're seeing in this new report. How big a deal is this?
Well, I think it's a really big deal because this is occurring even before the new rules regarding opioid prescribing are going into effect. So it's just showing that doctors are aware of the changes that are coming and it's already starting to affect their practice patterns.
Yeah, we'll get into those new rules in a bit, but what is it that's driving this decline in prescriptions? Is it just, as you say, awareness, or are there some parts of an effort that are already in place?
Well, I think it's mostly awareness. I mean, you know that there's been a terrible epidemic of opioid abuse and a frightening number of deaths related to both prescription drugs and non-prescription opioids. I think doctors can't help but realize that prescription medications can be a gateway to addiction and abuse. So I think that, and maybe if there's a part that they see that this is coming, and so they're starting to adapt their practice in advance of the changes that are mandated.
Yeah, let's talk about those changes that are coming. These are things that have come through changes in state law, as I understand it. What are these new mandates? When are they going to kick in?
Well, there's been two rounds of what's called HOPE legislation, heroin, opioid prevention, and education legislation that has been spearheaded by Representative Nygren. The most recent round have two that directly affect physicians. The first is that there's a mandated education requirement on the opioid guidelines. The guidelines were modeled after the guidelines from the CDC and adapted specifically for Wisconsin. And they help doctors to understand opioids and the rules for prescribing. The second mandate is the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. And starting in April of 2017, whenever a physician is writing a prescription for a class of medications that is in the mandate, they will have to access the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program to see if that patient has received prescriptions from other providers or what their use history is for controlled substances.
Talking to Dr. Don Dexter from the Wisconsin Medical Society about opioid medication prescriptions in Wisconsin. Some new data coming along, some new reporting, seeing a 10% drop in the number of written prescriptions for opioid medications, part of a wider effort to turn the tide on opioid addiction here in Wisconsin to both heroin, illegal medications, and prescription drugs. You mentioned changes in guidelines. What kind of things are we talking about, Dr. Dexter? Is this doctors being less likely to prescribe opioids for things like long-term chronic pain?
Well, maybe not so much for long-term chronic pain, but I think it's important to understand there's certain classes of people that are excluded. So if you are in hospice care, we don't have to. This is not an issue. If you're getting inpatient medication, if the doctor's prescribing medication, this is not an issue. So it shouldn't impact those at all. If you're writing a prescription for less than 3 days of medication, you don't have to check the PDMP. So for, you know, simple things, it won't be required. Now, for patients on longer-term medications or for higher quantities of medications, the doctors will have to access the PDMP. And so the guidelines are pretty clear that we want doctors to start low, that's as far as dosing and the amount of pills prescribed, and then go slow in any increase in dosing or pill number of pills dispensed.
That's been a concern all through this conversation about opioid addiction, is that, yes, we want to avoid these addictions, turn the tide if we can, but we don't want to go so far. There are some people who genuinely do need these medications. We want to make sure they can get pain relief they need. Do you think that is still going to happen?
Well, I think that's a really good point, Rob. I mean, we have to make sure. I mean, the pendulum swung way too far to over-prescribing these medications. There's a number of reasons why that happened. But we have to really caution against swinging too far the other way so the patients in pain still get cared for. But what we're learning is that there's lots of tools in the tool chest, and opioids are not the only one. So there's non-opioid medications that are very effective for many people with pain that are not addictive. There are non-medication approaches that can be used and should be utilized. And patients on chronic narcotics, I mean, we could always consider tapering off if their pain is not getting better and going to other modalities.
And as I understand it, in some cases, opioid medications are not the best answer. There may be not an answer at all to certain types of conditions and chronic pain.
Certainly. I mean, I'm a neurologist, and I still practice neurology, and I can tell you that my patients with pinched nerves or nerve pain often do not respond very well at all to narcotic medications. They don't seem to work for that type of pain very well. Now, for post-operative pain or for broken bones or sprained ankles or certain musculoskeletal things or, you know, other conditions, yes, opioids are a very effective medication in the short term. But I think the key for most patients is short term, and we want to make sure that we avoid giving too many medicines that either get into the system by being diverted, either stolen or misused in a home, or patients end up getting addicted inadvertently to medications that are provided for a good use.
A lot of what we're talking about is geared toward prevention, making sure people don't get addicted in the first place, which is great. What kind of things do you see out there for people who are already in that situation? They've developed that addiction, maybe from prescription medication, their own or someone else's. Are you seeing good moves being made to help deal with those addictions?
Well, we're certainly, that's a really good question. We're really working on that issue because those patients are out there, and with these new mandates, we're going to discover more. There's little doubt in my mind that this is going to uncover a bigger issue than we knew existed before. The problem is we have a shortage of physicians in Wisconsin, as you probably know, and this particularly acute in behavioral health. Our mental health specialists that help deal with addiction, it's a profound shortage, particularly in rural areas. So the medical society is working hard on developing educational programs to help doctors deal with this issue and help patients that have addiction problems, at least for the patients that are early in addiction or have problems that are amenable to, early interventions. Patients that have more longstanding or entrenched issues, we're going to have to work harder to try to increase the number of slots available for treatment.
We've talked a lot about opioid addiction on this show, elsewhere on Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of what we've heard about has been on the bad news side of the ledger. With Representative Nygren's law, we've talked to him on the show. With this new data, with this wider awareness, are you starting to see the tide turning? Maybe we're going to see more good news when it comes to our addiction rates in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. I think that this is fantastic news to see this kind of change this early. It means that we're ready for the change, and the tide is going to, you know, change on this fairly promptly. I think, you know, we have a lot to be proud of in Wisconsin, that we have, you know, the legislature led by Representative Nygren, the governor's office, the district attorney, the medical examining board, the Wisconsin Medical Society, and other medical groups all working together to address this serious problem. But this cooperative approach, I think, is really going to serve Wisconsin well, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Dr. Dexter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Dr. Don Dexter. He's Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Medical Society. He joined us to talk about the news that Wisconsin's written opioid prescriptions have gone down almost 10% over the last year. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll find out how a new generation of Americans is getting involved with politics, their community, and more.
First, the smash Broadway hit Hamilton is playing in Chicago right now to rave reviews. The show brings a lesser-known founding father, Alexander Hamilton, to the forefront and draws audiences in with a different view of the nation's early days, set to an award-winning hip-hop score.
Our next guest loved the show, but says that the musical glosses over or leaves out some key points of Hamilton's legacy and the realities of the young nation. Robert Sullivan is the author of numerous books, including My American Revolution. His cover piece for the October issue of Harper's Magazine is titled The Hamilton Cult, as the celebrated musical eclipsed the man himself. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So, full disclosure, I haven't seen Hamilton, and I feel like I've missed the boat in some ways. It's almost un-American not to be fully in on this Hamilton craze. What's going on here?
Well, yeah, I guess one of the things that's going on is that there is a tendency to feel a little like you're a little less than an American. You haven't done your patriotic duty if you haven't seen Hamilton. And in fact, I heard somebody kind of introduce an evening by saying, America is divided into two camps, those who have seen Hamilton and those who haven't. And I, at that point, had not seen Hamilton, and so, of course, immediately felt bad, but I tend to feel bad anyway. But, so one of the things is, like, why is there so much pressure to see this, and how can it possibly be sort of patriotic duty to see any play or musical? So I was sort of fascinated by that phenomenon. I had not seen it until right about when I was done with the article. So,
wow! So it was very soon as you were writing this article that you actually got to experience it.
Yeah, I mean, I had heard a lot of the songs, I'd seen bits and pieces of it, and it all seemed like it would make a really great musical. And of course, when I saw it, it's a really fun musical, really great. The dancing is amazing, the songs are terrific. I personally love King George. Couldn't believe how much I love King George. But just like right there, like who has seen the musical? That would seem to sort of imply, you know, a division right away. That kind of thinking about the musical is what I kind of got, you know, excited about and thought about when I sat down to write this piece. And really, the musical is really expensive. Like I couldn't afford to see it if I wasn't seeing it with, for a job as a press person. So it's really expensive. Like, who gets to see a musical like that? And these are some of the questions. So it turned out to be a lot about groups. Like, how do I think about the country? What groups would see the musical? What arguments in the musical are being made? And how do they appeal to certain people?
Talk a little bit about those arguments. Hamilton is credited for making order out of financial chaos and establishing a debt structure, and that was at odds with George Washington. What does it mean that this newly recognized and basically revered figure started building the national debt that is such an issue today among Americans and for our whole country?
Well, see, that's one of the things about the musical that's kind of, a little bit aggravating. So although I don't want to be aggravated, I want to be very happy. That's why I like the musical. The music was really great and made me really happy. So, yeah, Alexander Hamilton is a genius. He was a genius. He kind of figured out how to take all of the debt-laden states, organize them together into one nation. He assumed the debts. He sort of put all the debts into one debt. And that debt wasn't a bad thing. So a lot of people talk today about getting the national debt down. Conservatives primarily, but also Democrats talk about bringing the debt down now. Hamilton saw the debt as a tool, a way to kind of have a giant fund to grow the country. So two things went together, debt and kind of military force. So he would grow the country, have a military, a powerful military. Remember, the colonies didn't do so well with a bunch of scattered, poorly financed militaries against the British, and Hamilton was really envious and admired the British sinking fund system. Now, if you were going to do a musical about the sinking fund, nobody would go. People would fall asleep if you did get it on Broadway. They'd fall asleep within the first few minutes. because the sinking fund is incredibly boring. But it doesn't say that debt is bad. In fact, debt in some ways is good. So he created this debt, and he needed investors and government bond buyers. And basically, he needed Wall Street investors to finance this debt. So he built a whole country on this notion, and a lot of people didn't like this. And that's not, the play doesn't really explore the people didn't like this side, understandably, because it would bog down a great musical.
And he was very committed to putting down the Whiskey Rebellion, which was being fought by low-income, rural people, some of whom had just come back from fighting in the Revolutionary War. That doesn't seem to fit in with this status of this man that we're talking about, this great man.
Yeah, everybody had just finished fighting the Revolutionary War. And one of the points I try to make in the piece, that the revolution was not just one revolution. There were a series of revolutions, and smaller revolutions, a series of uprisings. Basically, the economic inequality that the colonies felt, the British government were kind of setting up for the colonies, was bad. People didn't want it. They didn't want to be, represented in tax without representation. And they felt like the sort of elite, if you will, in England were making money off of them. And as somebody said, I think in around 1774 or something, the 99 are paying all this money, and wealthening or fattening the one. It's like so out of the language of Occupy Wall Street. Anyway, there were a number of revolutions that kind of built and built, and people resisted the Stamp Act, all these acts. And finally, the kind of the sort of moneyed class in the colony says, you know what, we're going to start listening to the people who are not happy about this, which is most people, and we're going to join in with this revolution. And that kind of gives us the American Revolution. So after the American Revolution, people are saying, hey, great, this is great. We're going to deal with this economic inequality. I mean, this is one big current that happens in the revolution. Everybody says, terrific, great, terrific. And then all of a sudden, Hamilton comes in. Not all of a sudden, but after the Articles of Confederation fail, they start a new constitution, and he creates this sinking fund. He says, this is how we're going to run it, and we're actually going to tax you guys, the farmers, on your whiskey and stuff, and we're going to use that money to pay the investors, the government bondholders, and we're going to pay them interest. And we're not going to tax their interest. They're actually going to not pay taxes on that stuff. This did not make people happy, and Hamilton often referred to, or people referred to around Hamilton, referred to the Whiskey Rebellion guys, the farmers in Pennsylvania, all in the Appalachian Mountains, the other side of the Appalachians. He referred to them pretty liberally as drunk, like drunk poor farmers. And in fact, they were very interested in kind of social equality. A lot of the things you have in Wisconsin, you guys started, unemployment insurance. I remember there's a great memorial to that kind of stuff right near the Amtrak train station in downtown Milwaukee. But, a lot of the social movements that we take for granted today, like, I say, unemployment insurance, but Social Security, these things are being pitched by the Whiskey Rebellion farmers. They weren't against government as we would have it today in any way. In fact, they were very much for government, but they were against this inequality. So the play, sort of, I can't blame it, kind of papers over this. But there's one giant thing about the play, I'll say. Just essentially that while we do have Hamilton, we do recognize in the play that he is from the Caribbean, that he is he's a person of color. And while this is terrific, and while we have in the play people of color playing the white people of the revolution, the play in itself doesn't really go too far to represent the fact that there were a lot of people of color who were, for instance, slaves in New York. There really are very few people of color from the history represented in the play. Now, I don't even have a problem with that because I mentioned that the music was great and the play is terrific. But I guess the big thing is that it's really kind of falling into the rubric of great white men, and that wouldn't even be a problem so much, except that when you see who's kind of applauding the play, and everybody is applauding the play. You saw Bernie Sanders at the play, Hillary Clinton at the play, the Vice President Cheney was at the play, former Vice President. So was his wife, Lynn Cheney. But what's really interesting is that this plays out, this kind of idea of history, the sort of great white male history, American history, the emphasizing the positives and not emphasizing the any of the negatives, or dwelling with our school children on things like the Ku Klux Klan or Japanese internment, any negatives, that sort of thread of thinking is kind of played down by the sort of Hamilton thread of thinking. So you have a lot of people supporting sending kids to the play, young people to the play, and those people were against teaching kids in class kind of a multicultural history of America. So who's lining up for Hamilton is very interesting at this moment.
Robert, in the title of your article in Harper's, you ask whether the musical eclipsed the man himself. Has it? Is our image of him now likely to change with the times?
Well, I think we can say that it has changed, because Hamilton was the master of minutia, of sort of financial minutia. So we now think of him as this kind of amazing guy who, you know, was in a duel and kind of pushed these big ideas. And the guy was a genius. Just to read the Federalist Papers and all that he could churn out in minutes, he was an amazing writer, just really a genius. But he wasn't for the little guy, and that's kind of what's being lost here. So I personally hope that this encourages us to look at Hamilton and to look again at Hamilton and to kind of understand, you know, the minutia of what he's talking about. What does it mean to have a federal government that's based largely on, growth by the necessity of investors making money and the necessity of a large military? Is that being downplayed in the play for this kind of personal greatness of this one individual? And I hope it hasn't. I hope we haven't finished looking at Hamilton.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Robert Sullivan. He joined us to talk about the hit Broadway musical Hamilton and what parts of the Founding Fathers' legacy are missing from the play. Sullivan's cover piece for the October issue of Harper's Magazine is The Hamilton Cult. Has the celebrated musical eclipsed the man himself? And it's linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, Election Day isn't the only time to get involved in the world around us. Our guest shares his research on civic engagement in a digital age. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up at 6, WPR's election coverage kicks off on the Ideas Network with a special hour of NPR's On Point. At 7, all WPR stations will carry NPR's politics team, providing coast-to-coast returns on the presidential race and battleground legislative coverage. After the polls close in Wisconsin at 8, WPR will bring team coverage of state races. Stay with us all night for up-to-date election results.
Right now, election season, especially a presidential election season, brings a lot of people into public participation. People vote. They talk about politics. Some people get more involved, signing up to work at a polling station or work the phone bank or go door-to-door for a candidate or an organization.
What about the rest of the year? What happens when there's not a high-profile election to draw people into public participation? Our next guest studies civic engagement, the way people participate in politics and their communities, often through civic organizations. And he sees changes in American culture led in part by social media and a new generation finding different ways to get involved.
Chris Wells joins us now. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and the author of The Civic Organization and the Digital Citizen, Communicating Engagement in a Networked Age. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
Well, as we mentioned, civic engagement is more than just voting. When you're talking about civic engagement, what other activities, what kind of things are people doing that you're interested in?
Often we talk about a distinction between civic engagement and political engagement, although both we often refer to colloquially as civic engagement. So on the civic side, it would often be the more community-type activities that aren't necessarily explicitly political, don't have anything to do with a party or an election, but it's the things you do in a community. So you might volunteer at a hospital or something like that. That's a really civic activity. Or you might be a member of a community organization that decides how to spend some money or something like that. Then you have a whole range of political activities as well. So participation in political parties and those classic forms of engagement, but also calling your legislator if you feel a certain way about an issue, or even talking to your friends or posting something now on social media that reflects sort of an expression of how you feel.
Let's get into those civic organizations. When I hear that phrase, I think of things like Rotary, Kiwanis, that kind of group. Is that one of the things we're thinking about with civic organizations?
Definitely. So Kiwanis and Rotary, Lions Club are really classic civic organizations in the American civic experience. You know, 100 years ago, many of us would have been a member of one of these or even multiple of these, and they would have been really important in how we interacted with public life. It would have been a core part of our identity. That's less true now, but certainly those groups are still around, and there are some other groups that play really important roles in civic life and also in organizing the public for political activities.
It's been a few years now, but the sociologist Robert Putnam wrote his book, Bowling Alone, about how we're not getting together to bowl together and a lot of other things. You mentioned there's been a decline in people's participation in these civic organizations. Is that part of the same phenomenon? We're not joiners anymore like we used to be?
Yeah, so the way that I think of it is civic engagement has been largely deinstitutionalized. So it doesn't take place so much in these large organizations, which were some of the things that Robert Putnam was really interested in, like the Kiwanis Club and Lions, where you have a formal organization and you have leaders that are probably elected in some form and formal membership roles where you have to show up or you have to pay something like dues to be a member. So that's the kind of participation that has declined. That doesn't mean people aren't participating anymore, but they tend to do it outside of those kinds of institutions in more personalized ways.
Is there a similar thing going on with political parties where once upon a time a person might have actively gone to the local Republican or Democratic county meeting and now they answer yes to the pollster or pick a candidate based on that party alignment and that's it?
Or even not that. So we're seeing increasingly people are identifying as independents. So the gap of people who don't identify with either Democrats or Republicans or a third party is much larger. And so especially among millennials, so people under 35, a plurality of them have selected independents. They don't choose any of the parties.
Talking to Chris Wells from UW-Madison, looking at civic engagement, how we do it, how it's changing. And you mentioned, Chris, people aren't doing it as much as they used to through a formal organization, whatever that might have been. Does that mean we are less engaged, period?
There's a lot of debate about that. So in some ways, you could say yes, because those organizations structure such important parts of our civic engagement system. But on the other hand, there's lots of forms of participation that you can point to that people weren't very involved in a while back.
What kind of things?
So if you think about things like protest activities, the portion of people who have been involved in a protest or demonstration is pretty small. It's usually less than 10% in a survey, but it's actually larger than when that question was asked in the 1970s or even 60s, which we think of as a really large protest era. So people are definitely aware of the option to go out and express themselves in a public arena in that form. Certainly social media and new media in general have opened a lot of opportunities for political engagement as well. Perhaps the most basic is just sharing things on social media, something that you agree with. It might be an article or it could be something from a political party or organization that you're sharing and trying to make other people aware of. So that's really a form of involvement too.
But I wonder, does it count the same if you are in that organization or you're the person who's going to the community meetings or that, for Parks and Recreation, doing the Leslie Knope work where you show up in the thankless meeting week after week to get the park built, the block party created, the town cleaned up, whatever the thing may be, versus I share a link or I show up at a protest now and then. Is it the same?
That's a critical point. I'm not sure we can say whether it's the same or not, but I think you raised the just the really important point that involvement in those civic organizations that, as you point out, were often dull and laborious and tedious. They were critical for a lot of aspects of our community life, and they still are, and they're still being done by critical volunteers in our communities. So a really big question, especially for people who are trying to design some of the socio-technical systems, is how can we keep people involved? How can we maintain a level of commitment when a lot of people are preferring to at least begin their involvement through social media or some other digital form?
Well, we are, of course, on Election Day. I wanted to ask about one subset of trying to create a sustained organization, and that's, can you take something from a presidential campaign and build an organization going forward? People thought Green Party Ralph Nader run, that was going to be an ongoing boon to Green Party organization. Didn't really pan out. Now people talk about the Bernie Sanders campaign. Can that translate into something? You could look at something with Donald Trump, maybe the same thing. The Tea Party had some success there. What do you think about translating a political effort into an ongoing engagement effort?
I think you're going to see Bernie Sanders running up into some of the same challenges that Ralph Nader did, for the reasons that we've just talked about, that a lot of people aren't seeing those institutional avenues as really exciting ways to participate. The Tea Party's an interesting contrast because it was largely made up of middle and maybe upper middle class white people who, by and large, are still the most committed to those traditional forms of civic engagement. So in some ways, it had a built-in advantage that its main constituents were more prone to that type of civic involvement. Bernie Sanders, I think, is going to have a bigger challenge with that. And we've already seen with his Our Revolution political organization that it has struggled to keep its momentum even in these early stages.
You mentioned middle and upper class. And that makes me think there was once upon a time an organization through which a lot of working class people got involved in politics and in community efforts. It was called a union, and numbers are way down. How significant is that gap, not just in electoral politics, but in community engagement?
Yeah, so let me talk about unions in a second. But in addition to unions, which were critical for especially working class people, a lot of these larger civic organizations like Kiwanis or Lions or the veterans organizations were really important because they were cross-class organizations. Mm-hmm. They might not have been cross-race, and they might have been racist a long time ago, but they were critical because they actually integrated the social classes. So the decline of those things, I think, has contributed to some of the social fragmentation that we see between social classes. But unions in particular were critical because, as you say, they gave a voice to working people. And they are way down since their highs in the, I think, 1960s, 1970s. Union membership in the private workforce is way down, which means that one of the main avenues for working class people's political influence has been largely removed.
Chris Wells is with us. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. We're talking about civic engagement, involvement in politics and our communities, even when it's not Election Day.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a service organization or a political advocacy group? Did you get involved in local issues, showing up for a local government committee meeting, perhaps, advocating for or against changes in your community? Do you go online to get involved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear your story coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation with UW Communications and Journalism Professor Chris Wells. He studies civic engagement and public participation. We're talking about public involvement in politics and communities above and beyond Election Day.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you get involved in public life? Politics, sure, but local decision-making, doing things to improve your local community, Wisconsin, the world? Are you a member of a community group, a service organization like Rotary, Kiwanis, Oddfellows, Optimist, Lions, or other group, or maybe an activist organization, and do you participate in online activism? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, we were talking about a lot of old-time forms of participation, going to those meetings, participating in groups is on the decline. Karen on Facebook writes, the biggest impediment to social engagement is the long, irregular hours we're being asked to work. We can't get to regular meetings. And I've heard people with community groups say, we love students and retirees for, I think, exactly that reason.
Yeah, that's right. So that's something that we're finding in the research. You mentioned Robert Putnam earlier. So when he did his work in the 1990s, he was trying to figure out, why are people not participating in these groups the way that they used to a few decades before that? And originally, he actually pinned the blame on television. So he thought that he noticed that the declines began in the 1960s, around the time that basically all American households got TV. And so he sort of pinned it on TV. More generally, though, what was going on was what we refer to as the privatization of leisure time. So the time that you don't have to be at work, what are you doing with it? Are you spending it with a community organization, or Putnam thought you were spending it in front of a TV? But in fact, I think as we've learned more, we see that people's working hours, and especially in a neoliberal economy in which people are being forced to work multiple jobs, work very regular hours, their lives are more stressful, more strung out, and more irregular, so that what leisure time they have stops being something that they can consistently commit to a civic organization. So that's an important part of the story.
So we're going to call her now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Shullsburg. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Elizabeth?
Well, I have four younger brothers. I'm already graduated out of high school. I work most times. And I noticed that sports is a really big thing nowadays. Everyone's at least four sports a year. And most community activities is either involved with the church, with youth group meetings, and that really tends to more younger people. I mean, elementary students, middle school students, high school students, not so much. Hmm. And then 4-H and FFA is still a big thing, but it's not as popular as it used to be. When I was in high school, it was actually required that you had to have so many civic hours in before you could actually graduate, and they discontinued it because too many students were busy with their grades, academics, and sports. It's kind of sad to see that it's not as popular as it used to be or needed, I guess.
Elizabeth, thank you so much. You brought up so many interesting points. Chris, I'll let you run where you want to with that. A lot you could choose from there.
Yeah, so Elizabeth is describing some of the classic civic infrastructure of especially rural areas with 4-H clubs and Future Farmers of America and those types of organizations that traditionally, but still do, and 4-H is still very strong in a lot of places, give young people some key early experience in these types of civic organizations. And one thing that we do know from research on what we refer to as civic socialization, so how young people become socialized into civic norms, is that those types of activities in childhood are really important. It's too bad what the caller is describing about the opportunities being less and the emphasis increasingly going to academics and other things rather than maintaining that civic momentum.
Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for that call. We'll go next to Adam with us in Viroqua. Adam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Adam?
Well, I'm like said to the producer that I'm member of a motorcycle club down in Soldiers Grove, and we do a lot of stuff for the community. But I'm also a member of the Sons of the American Legion, and then I'm also a member of the Eagles. And the biggest reason that I got involved with all of that was because I want to do things for the community, because there really isn't much out there, you know, to do it. But I also found out, being in the motorcycle club, that a lot of the younger, and even with the Eagles, a lot of the younger, and I'm talking, you know, 20s and down, they don't want to join any clubs anymore because there's nothing in it for them. You know, that's one of the biggest complaints that I had. It's like they don't want to do something because they have to. They want to do it because they want to, and they're not getting really anything out of it.
Adam, thanks a lot for that call, and I'm guessing his organizations are not the only ones, Chris, with that concern about younger people not joining.
Oh, that was just so eloquently put. Absolutely. That's a major trend that we see across the board. So we've talked about some of the reasons behind that. But there is this issue of commitment also, I think, that we notice with younger citizens, that they tend to be quite attuned to the sorts of benefits that they're going to get from a particular kind of participation. And they may not find it as satisfying or rewarding to simply be a member of an organization that may be doing something for the community. And I think that comes from a lot of places, but to go back to something the previous caller said, especially at sort of the high school level, we put a lot of pressure on students to succeed in these highly individualized ways. So, you know, grades are completely individualized. You get one. And if you're spending your time doing something else, you're punishing yourself when it comes to your grade. So there is a generational issue there, and we're seeing it in research just the way that the caller describes it.
Adam, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Chris Wells from UW-Madison about civic engagement. Declining in some ways, changing, maybe growing in some others. We'll go back to our callers now with Terry in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I kind of wanted to expand a little bit on some earlier notions, and mine kind of goes towards, you know, kind of throwing out the book when it comes to civics entirely and kind of focusing on just the name of what you're talking about here, civic engagement, and kind of planting the seed at a younger age in regarding to, you know, getting involved in groups and advocating for issues and, you know, being part of things at a younger age and what that means at a local level and how they can also affect change. It's not about just going to the voting booth on the election day and cashing a vote. It goes well beyond that and getting involved with things, and we need to plant that seed at a much younger age.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. So you think start early, maybe scrap or cut back on these civics education and add more civics experience at maybe an elementary school.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We don't have a whole lot of civic education mandated in our country as it is, and in a lot of places it's fallen by the wayside, especially as we increasingly are teaching to the test and emphasizing STEM activities and so forth. So I think there's a lot of progress to be made in the civic education arena as well. But I would also add that for, you know, if you're a parent raising a kid, again, we know from the socialization studies that basically the biggest imprint on young people, on children when it comes to civics and a lot of other things, is their parents' activities. So if their parent is doing something, so my wife and I took our sons to vote today, which they liked because they got cookies. but if they're doing that or participating in other ways, that's one of the main ways that children will pick up their habits for civic life as they grow older.
As we start to wrap up, Chris, the white working class, that seems to be one of the biggest gaps in participation and opportunities to participate. What do you see coming up in the years ahead to maybe change that?
Yeah. So some of the biggest gaps and some of the greatest losses. So when we look at, you know, a big part of Donald Trump's story has been the frustration, economic, cultural, other ways that his white working class voters have felt. If you look at their opportunities for civic engagement and really their opportunities for influencing the political process through traditional mechanisms, that's where you really see the decline of unions as having a big effect. And, you know, I have to wonder to what degree that feeds a sense of powerlessness, because that's really what it is when your core institutions for engaging with the political process have declined so much. So I'll be really curious to see what is done in the next 4 years, whoever wins the election, to give those sorts of citizens more opportunity to engage with more traditional forms of politics than the Trump campaign has represented.
And you've studied a lot of digital engagement as well. We've only scratched the surface there. Is there a hybrid form, maybe a way for the traditional service organizations to spread their wings digitally and maybe get the best of both worlds?
Yeah, that's where some of the most exciting work is being done, is figuring out, especially when we're trying to reach these millennials who might be a little bit commitment focused, as we talked about with Adam, how we're going to reach them and give them entry points that make sense to them and are workable for them, while at the same time connecting them to those organizations that are so important for civic community life as well as political engagement.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Chris Wells. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's the author of the book, The Civic Organization and the Digital Citizen, Communicating Engagement in a Networked Age. We still want to hear your story, by the way. If you are engaged, if you're a member of one of these service organizations we were talking about earlier, the Kiwanis or Rotary or others, tell us about that on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're not, if you don't participate, talk about what could get you on board, what some of the hurdles are to getting involved in the community around you. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.